Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest. Because he is as greedy as the grave, and like death is never satisfied, he gathers to himself all the nations and takes captive all the peoples. Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying, "Woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion"? How long must this go on? Will not your debtors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? Then you will become their victim. Because you have plundered many nations, the peoples who are left will plunder you. For you have shed man's blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Woe to him who builds his realm by unjust gain, to set his nest on high, to escape the clutches of ruin. You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. The stones of the wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by crime. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire, that the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it is your turn. Drink and be exposed. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming around to you, and disgrace will cover your glory. The violence you have done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of animals will terrify you. For you have shed man's blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Of what value is an idol since a man has carved it, or an image that teaches lies? For he who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to wood, "Come to life," or to lifeless stone, "Wake up." Can it give guidance? It is covered with gold and silver. There is no breath in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him.
Well, a question we've been asking for the last few weeks as we've been going through Habakkuk, with breaks, because obviously I've been either on holiday or preaching somewhere else and other people have done other bits. But as we've looked at Habakkuk, we've been asking this question: where is God when the world falls apart? And the world falls apart in different ways. In the news at the moment, it seems the world is literally falling apart through war. And we've seen absolute wickedness. And it's bad enough in the news, but if you follow things like the Barnabas Fund information, things are far worse, as if they weren't bad enough, than things have been portrayed on the news. And there is no solution, it would seem. No political one, and no military one, as there's just standoffs. A while back, we had a credit crunch, didn't we, that was a global thing, and things still seem a bit shaky. At the time, the governments just started chucking money at it, and there was just that didn't solve the problem at all. It made no difference. And there's a risk that that might happen again. In fact, it is happening again in some countries. With the church, you read about what's going on in the wider church, even in what we call the evangelical church, and it just seems to have lost the plot. There are things that people do and believe that if you spoke to us 20 years ago even, we wouldn't have believed evangelicals would say that or do that. In belief and morality, lost the plot. And at the same time, you see, sort of contradictory, but these two big significant rises of Islam and secularism. Then closer to home, there are just disasters, aren't there? Personal disasters. In some ways, they're smaller. I mean, let's face it, they're not going to make the evening news. But because they're so close to home, they affect us so much more, and we feel it that much more. At the same time, there are certain things that we believe about God, about his promises and his character, We believe that he's absolutely sovereign, that he's in control over all things, and we believe that he is a God of love. How does that all square? And we've seen Habakkuk struggle with just that in so far. He's asked all those questions, and he will not let go of those tough questions. He will not be fobbed off with soft answers. And he's also held on firmly to the idea that God is good and sovereign and in control. And Habakkuk first asked God, well, why does the evil prosper in Israel, your so-called people? Why do they prosper? And then God tells him about Babylon, and it's going to be his instrument of judgment. They're going to virtually wipe out Judah. Well, that raises another question, and that he addresses to God. And in chapter 2, verse 1, Habakkuk presents a question and says, I'm going to wait for an answer. And what we saw there is he's asking very boldly, bolder than we might dare, but he also asks in faith, not from doubt. He's humble in that he's saying, I can't work this out. He's listening for an answer. And then we saw the answer, in part at least. In chapter 2, verses 2 to 4, we saw 2 points that we thought about, and it's going to come up again this week. First, there's a revelation concerning the end, and we saw actually it concerns a person, and we need to be ready and to wait. And secondly, by faith, the righteous will live, and that they will live by faith. We saw it means both of those things. And conversely, the proud, those who self-justify against those who will humbly depend on God and live out that dependence. Now, the rest of chapter 2 expands on that answer. The thing we didn't address last time is, what about those who are doing unjust things? What about them then? And the problem is there in verse 5. Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest. Because he is greedy as the grave, and like death he is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all the nations and takes captives of all the people. And the solution is in the start of verse 6. Will not all of them taunt him and with ridicule and scorn him, saying, woe to him, and so on. In other words, God will have the last say. That's the thing we know from this chapter, is God will have the last say. And so the rest of chapter 2 makes clear both the verdict and God's final say in the future. So that's the two things we're going to look at, the verdict and God's ultimate response. So firstly, the verdict. God makes it clear that Habakkuk's analysis is absolutely right. In fact, God goes a bit further. Habakkuk looks at the problem like we do. God looks at the heart of these evil people. And although there's about to be this Babylonian oppression and how they are poised to go into Judah, we may find as we look at this that these are more than just faint echoes of our own day. And the chunks are separated out by woe. It's like a ticking clock. Woe, woe, woe. So the first issue is greed. These people are making themselves rich. These are Babylonians. They're making themselves rich, but not from their skill or their hard work, but they make themselves rich at the expense of others. Look at that verse 6 again. Woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long will this go on? Not only that, but they seem unreachable. Verse 9. Woe to him who builds his realm by unjust gain, to set his nest on high to escape the clutches of ruin. So he's made himself rich at the expense of others by defended himself against the same thing happening in return. Could have done it legally, could have done it illegally. High fences, tight security, good insurance policies, top law team. And sometimes, you know, we've seen that in the news, maybe it's happened to you, that you felt cheated. There was that stuff a few years ago, wasn't there, with the pension funds collapse, so people make a lot of money out of you paying into your pensions, and then you come close to retirement. Oh, it's collapsed. But I've still got my mansion and my yacht, because that's all tied up in a different way. You can't get your money back. It's all protected. And what means do they use for this wealth? Well, in verse 12, brute force and violence. Well, you've just seen that in the news at the moment. you look at the Islamic State or ISIS. We should call them ISIS because apparently they don't like being called ISIS, so we'll call them ISIS. They're not making grounds by winning votes, are they? They're not winning any arguments. They just say, stay here and we'll chop your head off, or do what we want. Yeah, so you're really confident about what you believe then. They're just doing it by brute force. Similarly in Gaza, politics is very complex, but the solution is trying to be sorted out by brute force, by both sides. Just one side has a lot more brute force than the other. And it's not just brute force either in verse 12, but manipulation and seduction. Woe to him who... verse 15, sorry. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbours, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so they can gaze on their naked bodies. Now, we noticed before in Habakkuk this reference to alcohol, and Babylon has an issue with booze. And here, what they're doing is they're encouraging drinking, encouraging the others to have a drink in order to get something. It says to gaze on their nakedness, to make them vulnerable in whatever sense. That's not a huge leap to our culture, is it? You think of binge drinking and all the things that that leads to. And the root cause, Habakkuk, what God tells Habakkuk, is ignoring God. Replacing God with a void. You get rid of God, you have a void, and you just put something else into that void. Verses 18 to 19. Of what value is an idol, since a man has carved it, or an image that teaches lies? For he who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to wood, come to life, or lifeless stone, wake up. Can it give guidance? It is covered with gold and silver. There is no breath in it. So in our culture, that works its way out in different ways. Other religions, or a sort of caffeine-free version of Christianity, or a million other ways that we can just replace God in some way. And God makes it clear through Habakkuk that that's what the problem is. And let's be clear, this is what he's getting across here, that people are accountable. And this sounds very close to home once we give it a bit of thought. And people might read Habakkuk and say, but I'm not like that, that's not me. But it is, it's a picture of our society, and we're all complicit in some way in this. If you start to dig deep enough, you start making the connections that this isn't that far away. Now, certainly it's not true that if you make money, it must be at the expense of someone else. The Bible doesn't teach that. If you look at the sort of economic codes in Leviticus, it seems that you can create wealth and spread it. It's not bad to try and get the best price to make your best profits and pass that on to others. That's not a problem. But some things that we benefit from are at the expense of others. And it is, frankly, hard work to work out when we're doing that. But at the very least, we sit comfortably, not worried about what's happening to others in the world. Are we really that beyond verse 15? Even if we're not quite as bold as that. And certainly we find our substitutes for God in different ways. And the better we know ourselves, the more uncomfortable these verses sit with us. People who think we're all innocent, well, they're just kidding themselves. That's the verdict. Well, what's God's response? Well, through the chapter, there's been that one word. Like I said, it's been repeated like a drumbeat. Woe, woe, woe. We see these things do not slip past God, and he will deal with them. Some in the now, some in the future. Some appear to be cause and effect, but it's not just a natural outworking. God is at work in the world, dispensing his justice. And we see God is the God of history, and that kingdoms rise, the purposes God has for them, and then they fall. And the wicked, it seems they get away with it, and they do, for a time. But even then, there's a day of reckoning beyond that. That's great when you see what's happening in the news, and we think, they're getting away with it. Well, for a time. But ISIS won't exist forever. And one day, they'll have to face God. And you hear those atrocities, and they're going to have to look at God to the face and deal with that. And so, verses 6 to 8, wealth at others' expense. Well, it says the plunder will be plundered. And verse 7, it's interesting, look, playing Hebrew here. You may not realise this, but if you are, like myself, a native Essex person, you are a natural to learn biblical languages. Because if you say, it ain't nothing, which is very bad English, is very good Greek. And in Hebrew, you know, we might say, if you speak English properly, you don't say this, but that'll learn you. Very good Hebrew, because they have one word and it just works in both directions. So here, you've got creditor and debitor. And in the some Bibles, you say, it could be creditor, it could be debitor. And you think, they're opposite things. But the question is which way does the debt flow? So you could say, well, they owe the Babylonians money. But of course, in another sense, the Babylonians owe them the money because they've nicked it. And there's another interesting, Hebrew has fewer words than English. The word for creditor or debitor, because it's the same word, also means to bite. So there's a play on words here that the creditors will rise up, or it's like your debitors will bite you. You've been stealing off them, they're going to come back and they're going to bite you. It's going to all turn round. We think they've made money, but in fact, it's all built on sand. It's all very vulnerable. And not only that, but their security, it seems so solid to them and to us, but it's all going to come down. The stones themselves will cry out. Verses 12 to 14, the one who builds empires, their own house, not just their empire, their own house will topple. And the contrast is these empires seem so permanent, but the contrast is with God's kingdom. If you look at verses 13 and 14, has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire? The nations exhaust themselves for nothing. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In the end, that's all people will know. It's God's kingdom. And the judgments now look more and more future. So the thing about drinking, you like a drink? God says, I'll give you a drink that will bring you shame. Verses 16 to 17, it's the cup of God's wrath. We'll come back to that in a moment. And then his response to idolatry in verses 18 to 20, there's a contrast between the real God and an idol. And that's the judgment in itself. An idol is attractive. It's covered in gold. And also, have you noticed that the gods you invent in your mind always agree with you? Have you noticed that? I think I should do this. What do you think, invented mini God? I think that's a great idea. Go and do it. Brilliant. You're a great God. And it always agrees with us. What do you think of me? I think you're brilliant. So do I. You're a great God because I've invented you in my own image. So we never disagree. But here's a problem. They're lifeless. They can't guide us because they always think the way we're going is right until we get to the dead end. The contrast comes at the end of the chapter in verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let the earth be silent before him. This is the bottom line. God is God. God is God. Everyone else should just shut up and listen. Have you ever been in that situation, and apologies if it's ever with me, but have you ever been in that situation and someone is just holding forth and they're just giving his or her opinion and they're just kind of like, blah, 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 I think this and we should all do this. And it turns out someone in the room is actually an expert. And then the one holding forth looks a bit sheepish. A couple of times I've been asked to speak on a theological thing in front of other ministers, and a word of advice I've given to other people who've done that is always be very provisional and don't sound like an expert, because chances are there is one in the room and it's not you. And I know that because I've seen other people make fools of themselves by doing it. But you've been in that, haven't you? It could be politics, it could be sailing, it could be anything, and someone's just going, oh, I think, eh. And then there's an expert, and they just look ridiculous because of it. The image you get here in Habakkuk is the whole world is doing that. The whole world is holding forth. I think this, I think that, I want this, I'll do this. Nobody's going to stop me. Verse 20. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let the earth be silent before him. Shut up. Similar phrases come ring through the other prophets, and they're picked up in Romans 3:19. And what you get in Romans 3 is this list of one-liners from the prophets that we come across all the prophets, and they speak about how we've sinned against God. We've all done this. None of us have done that. And the consequences are spelt out as well, and all these one-liners. And it ends with this, that we know that we're all accountable before God. Be silent. There is nothing to say. No defence. The evidence is all laid out before you. You can imagine people going, oh yeah, but, and then you go, God says, no, here's the evidence. Now what have you got to say? Nothing, because the evidence is all there. What hope is there? Well, Babylon has been sent to bring God's judgment on Judah, and they themselves will also face it. They will drink the cup of God's wrath, and they will receive the full just penalty for their evil, as will everyone else. It's not an isolated idea. The cup of God's wrath is used several times in the prophets, but also it's used by Jesus, who just before he goes to the cross described what he's about to do as drinking from the cup. And this ties in with what we're looking at now, with what we looked at last week. The righteous, by faith, will live. God will deal with every sin. That's a frightening thought, isn't it? Every sin that everyone has committed, including you, is going to be punished by God. It's going to be dealt with. There will be justice. And that is a huge problem, because we're all sinners. And when we truly see the evidence before us, what will we do? Shut up. Because there's no health in us. We don't stand a chance. Every sin will be accounted for. The question is, by who? Well, that comes back to what we looked at last week. If you're self-justified, that means you go, well, I try my best, I don't do anyone any harm. When the evidence is put out there, shut up and drink this. Take the consequences on ourselves, and that will be just and right and fair. But by faith, the righteous will live. And another takes the cup for us. And so that means at the heart of all these complex, difficult questions, and they are complex, difficult questions, is the gospel itself, something very simple. And the reason why the Bible's so long is because the detail is about day-to-day living. It just works its way out in so many ways. But it's significant, isn't it, that the gospel is the answer to the questions of injustice and how God controls history and keeps his promise. And there's a lot more to be said. That's why there's books like Job and so on for us to grapple with. But the answer's simple, but the impact is deep, because we saw last week how the New Testament picks up on those verses at the start of chapter 2. That not only by faith do we live, because another takes up our cup, but we live by faith. We know what's wrong with the world. We know that God is in control. We know that justice is coming, final judgment. And that makes a difference for everything now, doesn't it? Let me give you an example of how that... I'll read it to you again from the start of Habakkuk 2. We looked at last week. And it says at the end of verse 3, though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. And then it says, see, he's puffed up. His desires are not upright. But the righteous will live by his faith. Or by faith the righteous will live. Can be read either way. And let me give you an example of living by faith. In 1920, the war between Greece and Turkey was drawing to an end. And in Smyrna, the city of Smyrna in Greece, which is now Izmir in Turkey, the city fell. And along that area, that sort of land bridge between Greece and Turkey, about 2 million people died just in that last year. But it could have been so many more. What happened was the rich people left, because they went off in their yachts or whatever. All the British and the Americans left. And all that was left were the ordinary Greeks, the Armenians and the Jews, and they were doomed as the Turks, the Muslim army, was coming in. And so what the ordinary people had was behind them a city on fire. Beyond that, they could see the Turkish army's camp. And in front of them, they could see the sea. There were ships in the sea, but no one would come and rescue them because they feared the Turkish response to them. And they didn't want to get involved. One American stayed. A Methodist minister who was deployed to the YMCA. His name is Asa Jennings. And I've got a description of him. It's obviously academically highly credible because I got it from Google. Asa Jennings, he was 5'5". From a previous illness, he had a curved spine. He was always ill and apparently wore thick-rimmed glasses, although I don't know what's wrong with that. "Oh, I've been given bad advice." When he grinned, apparently he looked like a frog. He had had a number of jobs in the States and around Europe as a Methodist minister or for the YMCA. He had had no impact in any of them. But he was a man of faith, and he refused to leave the people. And so he rang the Greek Navy to inform them of the situation, and they replied, "Who is Asa Jennings?" And he replied, "I'm the director of the American Relief Committee." He said later, writing about it, he was that on the basis of being the only American in Smyrna. They refused to help him. It turns out later, as we now know, that the reason why the Navy wouldn't help is because they were planning to overthrow the government the following week. But he then threatened if they didn't come to the rescue that he would put this conversation on the open airwaves so that all the media and the merchant navy would know that the Greek Navy would not rescue their own people. He then, whilst negotiating that with the Greeks, crossed over enemy lines to meet with the leader of the Turkish military. It was the actual leader, finished up being the Turkish president after the war, and negotiated a ceasefire. He rescued thousands of people in one day and hundreds of thousands over the next few weeks. Interesting aside to that story is after the war, the Greek government needed a representative, a neutral who they trusted, but also the Turks would listen to, and they appointed Asa Jennings. The Turks also needed someone to do that and appointed Asa Jennings. And so it finished up that for the first and last time in history, both the negotiations was done by one man. The Greeks view him as a hero. Apparently they would literally bow down to him in the streets and kiss him and thank him for saving their lives. The Turks revere him as a wise man. He was used as a government advisor to rebuild what we now call modern Turkey. Why? There's only one significant thing about this little crooked man with a funny smile, is he was a man of faith. Because it meant, from his perspective, he had nothing to lose because he already had everything. So if because of our faith we live, because someone else has taken the cup for us, because Jesus did not pass over his cup, then that also means not only by faith do we live, but we can live by faith. Now, much of the time, that's just going to look like getting on with things. And you may feel that you're living by faith and you're making no difference at all. But you might just be. You don't know it. An act of kindness, perhaps. Or knowing the holiness of what this world offers. Knowing that the just fires of God's judgment are behind people and there's nothing in front of them to rescue them. You speak the gospel to someone. Or you invite them to something that we're doing or whatever, where they're going to hear it. And that just spread around through ordinary people like us. Others come to know that great truth. And by faith, we can make all the difference to someone else. God's judgment is fair. It's good. It's just. You see things on the news. We may not have an answer. It seems that no one else does. But there will be justice. There will eventually be knowledge of God, and it will cover the world as the waters cover the sea. And as sobering as that is, so it is just as marvellous that the cup is taken, so that by faith we're made righteous, so we'll live. And then we have a duty as we live because of our faith, so that we live by that faith. Let's pray. Well, we thank you for this sobering reminder, but as well as sobering, we know that it's good news that you bring justice on the unjust. And all these atrocities we see in the world and these injustices that we experience ourselves have not slipped past you, and people will have to pay for that. But we are also aware that we are part of the problem. And we thank you that by faith we can live because one has taken the cup for us so that we don't have to face it. Please help us to have faith in that so that we might live. And by that faith, we would live it out as well. And we ask this in the name of the one who took the cup for us. Amen.